This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And this is Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence coming to you from New York City. We talk to citizens who are most impacted by the latest scratch-your-head federal policies and bring you the most interesting guests we can find. We are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Today, we are very fortunate to have in our studio Garnet Cadogan, noted essayist and journalist. His research explores the promise and perils of urban life, the vitality and inequality of cities, and the challenges of pluralism. And we are also very lucky to have hip-hop artists, Fellow Man, a.k.a. Cullen Wade, and Remy St. Clair here with us. But before we do that, I want to ask if Nancy is there.
Ellen, I am here, man. I am absolutely here. It worked. I'm with you, in spirit, anyway.
Okay, great. I'm so glad you're there.
I know, I don't take it for granted, believe me.
Right.
I really don't.
I want you to know, today is the mother of all radio shows.
Oh, my goodness. I love it. I hope it's not traveling over Afghanistan, but other than that, I think that's excellent.
Yeah.
At least not for the next hour.
I do wish they would take Mother off of the, in a kind of a serious note, take Mother off of a bomb, please. I mean, it's kind of an insult to women and to that country.
Yeah, no, as I recall, his giving states the rights to defund Planned Parenthood was, I think it was the same day the mother of all bombs dropped, you know, ironically and sadly, as you... So it always, when you talk about that guy, it's always going to go south really quickly. I mean, it's, you know, I'm actually even stunned that he didn't wind up at the White House this weekend simply so he could read from his The Art of the Deal. I figured he would think that was a perfect Easter story. And so he would stay in D.C. and treat the kids to some tales of his, you know. Anyway, but...
Yeah.
Yes, here we are talking about it. Or I am.
I know.
Anyway,
well, there's so many things that are going on with that it's hard not to... I don't know. For me, it's hard not to bring them up. But did you have anything...
Yeah.
I mean, I could go on. I mean, health inspectors at Mar-a-Lago, 15... Did you hear that? 15 violations in late January.
I did. Yes. I know. And of course, they... what did they say? They cleared it up with like the wave of a hand. You know, it was done before the inspectors left or something. You can't believe anything.
I didn't know that. I just heard unsafe seafood, insufficiently refrigerated meats, rusty. It's kind of gross to talk about. But cooks without hair nets. This is right before the Japanese guy was there, the prime minister.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. No. He's all smoke and mirrors, and apparently with a letter E from the sanitation department or something, a failing grade. Yeah, he is the art of nothing, truly.
Yeah. In thinking about this, I came across something interesting to me anyway, that the word chauvinistic, really, what it really means is aggressively and blindly patriotic, especially one devoted to military glory. So
patriotic.
Yeah, that's the actual
definition. They get the market on that.
Right. Huh. So it just seems fitting to me to mention that. You know, instead of the mother of all bombs, we should just call it chauvinistic.
His small, teeny tiny self-esteem and his need for constant praise. That's the thing that's bothered, you know, among other things, but that's the thing that bothers me about the accolades he's gotten for his decisions, which who knows if they're even his, but is, you know, I think he's just, we're encouraging him to do this, you know, to bump up his stupid ratings or at least get a good column in a paper.
Right. You know, many problems with this administration. I wanted to talk about a couple of things, if that's okay with you, some events in
that
town.
Is, That is okay.
Actually, they're not in town. One is. Two marches on D.C. because, as we were saying, there's so many things to protest. The March for Science, April 22nd in D.C., People's Climate March, April 29th. And I wanted to promote the station is also sponsoring the Nine Pillars Hip Hop Cultural Festival next week, April 17th to the 23rd. That's this Monday through next Sunday. And we are going to talk in depth about that, which brings me to the amazing show that we have.
Yes, that's quite a segue you built for yourself there. It's very impressive.
Oh, why, thank you. I couldn't do it without you. So our first guests are Cullen Wade, also known as Fellow Man, and Remy St. Clair. Wade and St. Clair are hip-hop artists, founders of Rugged Arts, and are organizing the Nine Pillars Hip-Hop Festival in Charlottesville next week. So welcome, Cullen, and welcome, Remy.
Hello.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Hi, world.
And you guys are doing quite the media blitz, I hear.
Yeah, you got to hit them from all angles.
That's right. You know? So the nine, I mean, one of the things I love is the nine pillars. Most talented high school age rappers is like the first thing. It seems like the first thing that you're kicking off on Monday. What is the purpose of this festival?
Well, the purpose of the festival, this is Fellow Man, by the way.
Yes, Cullen Wade.
That other voice was Remy St. Clair.
That's very nice. You guys are doing. I know you guys do have radio background. No wonder you're right on the idea of who's speaking. That's perfect. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. That was
you're
Nancy.
You're welcome.
The voice
I haven't done
heard.
It for more than a month. But sure, whatever.
I do expect rap names at the end of this.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Well,
yeah. No, you got.
We got you.
Thinking about.
Okay.
You thinking about.
Okay. Awesome.
So the nine pillars of hip hop. Otherwise known as the nine elements of hip hop. Mm-hmm. They include DJing, MCing, breakdancing, graffiti art, beatboxing, street knowledge, street fashion, street language, and street entrepreneurialism, trade, and business. Those are the building blocks of the culture, which is known as hip hop. For those of you who are not aware, it's a lot more than rapping and spinning around on your head, and vandalizing walls and subway trains. So what we wanted to do was take a city like Charlottesville, which is extremely divided, in which there's a very large population that really does not know what hip hop is, and, sort of bring it to them. And we, have been talking about this for years, and we finally realized that we have enough resources and enough connections to actually make it happen. And to my knowledge, I've been saying to my knowledge, in my promotion of this so far, I'm waiting for somebody to disprove me. That's why I keep saying to my knowledge, because I don't want to proceed without evidence, and make a blanket statement. But to my knowledge, this is the first week-long hip hop cultural festival celebration of all things culturally hip hop that Charlottesville has ever had.
Mm-hmm.
That's impressive. I'm just going to interrupt to say that. That's impressive. That's the first one. I mean, congratulations on, you know, putting that together. I'm sorry. Continue.
Oh, thank you. No, that was it. That was my answer to the question of what nine pillars and why nine pillars.
Yeah. And is the, before I actually, what are some of the activities you have on the schedule for this week that you have set up?
All right, so I'll give you the rundown real quick, and then you can ask me, you know, more details about anything, you know, anything that you're interested in. So all week we have a an exhibit of graffiti art at the Bridge Art Gallery. Our friends were kind enough to come and do some live painting, actually, on some plywood boards, and also bring some canvases and some pre-made work, and that was up all week at the Bridge. It's going to be down for the first few days of this week, but then it'll be back up all day, all week next week, starting on Friday. And anybody can come in at any time and have a look at that. So on Monday, we have the freshman class, a.k.a. The high school showcase. Students from local high schools performing music and getting prizes for the best one. On Tuesday, we have a lecture called Black Rhymes Matter. A fellow from Richmond named Mike Medic is going to come and talk about social justice topics in rap lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
On Wednesday, we've got the Build a Bar workshop with Bernard Hankins and Liberation Arts Circles with Professor Macaco Nova York. He's going to be talking about it's a lyric writing workshop and a collaborative improv class. On Thursday, we have a film screening of a documentary called Wall Riders about the early days of graffiti culture on the East Coast. That's going to be with guests Mike 171 and SJK 171, who are featured in the film, legendary graffiti artists from New York. Friday, we have Rugged Arts Hip Hop Showcase with many of our local talented friends going to be performing. On Saturday, we have the Rap Battle, No Filter Rap Battle. Sunday, Verbs and Vibes Open Mic and the Block Party.
So for some people, perhaps like my mother listening, hopefully somewhere in Florida, what could you give us a little breakdown about the history of hip hop, the highlights, the high points, what you think is important, how it started and where?
Hip hop was started in a struggle, like a lot of art forms. You find that beautiful roads in the concrete to help you get through this trying times and also the day at hand. 67.
The year.
Was when it was started.
Okay, that's way before I thought.
Yeah. And it was started up top in New York.
Mm-hmm.
South Bronx.
Yes.
Is that right?
That's it.
Do I have my facts right?
Somebody been doing their research.
Knowledge.
I love it.
Yeah.
But that's, and that's also, you know, that's one of the pillars, that knowledge that you have to have in order to fully understand hip hop. And the forefathers of hip hop, the founders of hip hop, the ones who innovated the sound, created this music not to, you know, glamorize drug use, not to glamorize sex, not to glamorize the high life, but to shed light on the struggle and to show how to progress out and to tell the stories to those that are under you in hopes that they won't have to repeat the story that you did. So you're giving that guidance to those under you. And it was started in urban communities, but hip hop has reached out and branched out to everybody. And it's a very, very popular voice and a very loud voice at this point in time.
Thank you. That was Remy St. Clair. We're talking also with fellow man Cullen Wade, and this is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Apropos of Something on Saturday mornings. Also, something that comes to mind, being a little naive about the topic, I think there's a lot of negativity associated with it. Can you address that and talk a little bit about that?
Where to start? Where to begin? You know, there's a lot of negativity associated with country music. There's outlaw ballads and glorification of bank robbers and cop killers.
Yeah.
Shooting down Sheriff Pat Garrett and what have you. There's a lot of negativity in folk music. You have murder ballads. There's a lot of negativity in rock and roll, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll stereotype. There's a lot of negativity in classical music. I heard that Orpheus's Descent into the Underworld is the piece which is now known as the Can-Can. Dun, 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 dun.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a jaunty dance that glorifies Satanism.
Yeah.
So if you're going to talk about negative messages in musical forms, you know, hip hop is no better or worse than any other form.
Do you think that the marketing had anything to do with it? I did a little reading, and I saw that in the 80s, the music industry was partly responsible because they really wanted to capitalize on, I'll just quote, a titillating buffet of hyper-masculinity and glorified violence. And so, and it was marketed to the new fan base in the 80s, which was white males. So, and ignoring exactly, Remy, what you were saying, the depiction of the harsh reality that really the way it sprouted, where it came from.
Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty fascinating. Again, marketing plays a role. I have a tune I would like to play. It's probably not the appropriate way to describe it. A piece.
Okay.
I'd like to play. In the meantime, why don't you introduce it while I find it? It is the one with some champagne. I think it's both of you two.
Ah, Champagne Chardonnay.
Yes, sir.
Okay, cool.
Right.
So this is fellow man and Remy St. Clair, Champagne Chardonnay. You can call it Sons of Ichibe. This is a piece we did a few years ago, and it's been one of our more popular pieces and one of my favorite pieces to perform because I get to perform it with my brother. So,
yeah.
Excellent.
Celebrating life. And shouts to Finn Downey, who helped us record and mix this version of the track.
Most definitely.
Here we go.
Woo! the hole. It's just a better way to roll. As long as I got my radio to elevate the soul, and my friends and family got my back when the tempest ain't below. That's what I'm grateful for. Plus that I'm able to blaze a show with no while I suppose the pros, and on my level with the sacred flows. And I base that boast on what?
Firm grounding.
Seven seas unfathomable, yet superb sounding. Like consciousness, conscience, character, and concentration, classiness, cunning, and of course, celebration of small joys, not just promise.
That's just a little bit of it. I want to have more time to talk to you fellows, but that, I mean, talk about positive. I heard great gratitude and celebration. That's catchy. You guys, where can we listen to, if people want to catch more of your music, where would they find it?
I put a mixtape out last year. Not a ton of positivity on that particular project. but there's a couple, there's a few bright spots, a few rays of sunshine peeking through the clouds. It's called Raw Data Volume 1. With the rest of the title, which is not radio friendly. Actually, Ellen is sitting underneath a poster of it right here in the studio there.
I am as well, actually.
Oh.
Awesome.
What do you know? News travels.
So well done on your part.
Yeah. And that's on Bandcamp, fellowmanrap.bandcamp.com. And Remy St. Clair, where can they find more Remy St. Clair?
So you can find Remy St. Clair on... I was about to say Bandcamp as well. I have not advanced to Bandcamp just yet, but you can find me on SoundCloud. Just type in Remy St. Clair, and you'll be able to hear a lot of my products there. And also on Facebook, you can find Remy St. Clair on Facebook, and Remy St. LaCroix. My music is connected to those pages.
Cool. So, Nancy, we have time for about one more question. Do you have a burning question?
I actually have a question for both of you, and I know you can't answer at the same time, but I was curious for both of you.
As Amy Goodman says, 20 seconds.
What drew you to rap as your form of expression? What was it about it?
Oh, for me, it was my mother sitting me down in front of a cassette player saying, "This is music." And, you know, and ever since then, you know, that's been my go-to. You know, I've saved myself a great deal of hospital visits and stress by learning how to write and how to craft my words and use them in light instead of in darkness, like hip hop is, you know, made out to be. So that's what really drew me towards hip hop and the flair of the culture, the style, everything. It just felt like home.
That's amazing. Thank you.
For Remy, it was mom turning on a cassette player and saying, "This is music." For me, it was dad turning off a cassette player and saying, "This is not music." So, that's how I
That's great.
It.
I love how
the
you
rebel, the rebel.
Love how you compliment each other. We're going to have to go to a hard break.
Right.
And when we come back, we're going to be talking with Garnet Cadogan. He's a writer and essayist. He likes to focus on the world through his walking. Thank you both so, so much.
Yeah. And you're like the perfect organizers for this event. I mean, it's going to be amazing. Yeah.
Thank you for having us.
Again, it's the Nine Pillars Hip Hop Festival going on in Charlottesville this week. That's the upcoming week, 17th to the 23rd. Check them out everywhere and on Facebook. Thank you, guys.
SevilleHipHop.com. You're welcome.
There you go. SevilleHipHop.com. Welcome back. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, and you're listening to Apropos of Something with me, Ellen Daniels, and Nancy Lawrence in New York City. Every Saturday morning, we come to you on this program. And today, we are very honored to have with us our second or third guest, actually. His name is Garnet Cadogan. He is a noted essayist and journalist and co-editor of a bunch of stuff. And, you know, before I get into that, I think I'm going to let him settle in a little bit. I wanted to talk about... As if we haven't already, Nancy. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay.
I am there. I'm
sorry.
I didn't want to interrupt. Yes.
Do you have a disaster of the week?
Ellen, of all things that you should ask me, I haven't, of course, and I'm the mother of all weeks. I have a mother of all disasters, and it's not that one. It's another one. It's Jeff Sessions, our attorney general. He's ordering federal prosecutors to find ways to criminalize and convict more and more immigrants and undocumented workers. And to meet the demand, he's hiring three times the immigration judges, you know, to get them into these private prisons that the federal government is also re-upping as opposed to phasing out. That's another aspect that he's he's into, and all because, you know, they have made, the prisons have made big contributions to Trump, and Sessions has stock in their portfolio, in their companies. And in addition, he's, of course, tossed out the need for a forensic science panel that would raise the forensic science standards so that innocent people aren't languishing in prisons. Mm-hmm. That is my disaster. What do you got?
I have two words for mine, and thank you for your contribution. my two words, Holocaust centers.
Yes.
I cannot go without mentioning the despicable way this administration talks about history and people who you know, have been oppressed in the past and are continuing to be oppressed. Anyhow, that was horrible for me.
Were you surprised that Spicer kept his job after that?
Yes. Well, yes and no. I mean, but yes.
Yeah.
Especially given Jared Kushner, you know. Especially.
You know, I think we should stop focusing on the fact that guy's Jewish. I don't think it, you know.
I know.
I think it matters.
I know.
It doesn't matter.
I know. It doesn't matter. So let's talk about something really much more happy, which is our next guest. He is a friend and just a wonderful person and a scholar. His name is Garnet Cadogan. His research explores the promise and perils of urban life, the vitality and inequality of cities, and the challenges of pluralism. He's received research fellowships from Yale, University of Chicago, New York University, and UVA. Garnet is writing a book on walking. So welcome, Garnet.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, you're very welcome. So you look at the world, you look at society and politics through walking. It is a big theme for you. Can you tell us how that came about?
It was almost happenstance, really, that as a kid I was in a home that I wanted to be away from, and so I always took the long route back. So rather than scurrying home after school, as all my other classmates did, I lingered at some friend's house or another friend's house until it was time for them to kick me out and everybody had to go to bed. And of course, by that time, there was no public transportation running, and so it was either take a cab home or walk, and not having the deep pockets for a cab then, being a 10-year-old, I'll just walk home. And so I began almost by necessity, really. And as time went on, it just became this delightful thing for me because of all the different people I encountered and the way the streets were full of life. And so it became walking by choice.
And you were in Kingston, Jamaica. I don't know if we mentioned that. That's where you did your initial walking?
Yes, I was hoping that the accent would give me away.
Maybe, for some.
But it doesn't always work. I remember once calling a radio station. They were having a giveaway prize because I eventually moved to New Orleans for school, for college. And the person with the best Jamaican accent would get a round-trip ticket. So I call, speaking the thickest Jamaican accent. I said, sorry, try again. And then someone calls a few minutes later and goes, Irie, I'm from Jamaica. And that person won. So maybe I shouldn't depend on the accent to help me.
Yeah, seriously. So can you talk a little bit more about how you found the streets of Kingston and then when you moved around the country or the world, I should say, how that differed?
Well, with Kingston, it was just this marvelous. It felt like an ongoing party that never ended. I mean, part of it because the streets are so alive with music that as opposed to the typical concert venue that so many people had their houses at, got transformed into concert venues, so to speak. The dance hall, as we may come to know it, which is one way to describe a genre of music, contemporary Jamaican music, popular music, but it's also a way of describing the way people congregate around music in a huge speaker boxes piled miles high, in a bass pumping, you know, through the entire neighborhood, and people just paying to enjoy themselves and dancing in an open air outdoors. Whether it's somebody's yard or a space converted to be in a party central. And so many times it's just walking and seeing the streets alive with music, whether it be the official dance halls or music pumping from a bar in someone's home, you know, very friendly people, you know, warm people just embracing on the street. And, you know, Jamaicans are nothing if not, you know, full of wit and stories. And so it was me walking home and encountering story after story after story, and of course told with real aplomb and humor and generosity, And so who wouldn't want to keep encountering that?
Mm-hmm. And then, if there's more to that, let us know. But I know then you moved after that. Where did you go, and yes. How is that different?
So I moved. I eventually moved and went to New Orleans. So I'd grown up in Jamaica, up into my 20s, and then moved to New Orleans for college. And thought, oh, I'd just take on the streets the way I'd always taken them on in Jamaica. Just throwing myself and walking around and exploring the streets and learning about it encounter by encounter, experience by experience. Plus, of course, it was New Orleans. New Orleans is famed for its streets. Brass bands dancing through, Mardi Gras Indians, as they call them, people dressed in these wonderfully resplendent colors and, you know, singing songs that have even their own secret historical code. You can think of that song, Aiko Aiko. And so I just wanted to make my way through the streets, explore New Orleans, in all its colors and its resplendence. And so I started making my way through the streets then, thinking, oh, well, I'll just do what I did in Jamaica. And as it turns out, I couldn't do what I did in Jamaica. Not merely because of simple cultural differences, but because of one particular stark difference, which was when I was walking around the streets of Jamaica, I had to be streetwise, as you have to be in any city, and be attuned to the kind of fears that could come my way and adjust my behavior to control for that. But when I came to New Orleans, I discovered that I also had an extra dimension, one I couldn't even have anticipated, which was the ways in which I would be a danger because of being black, the way in which people would be apprehensive or fearful or concerned about my very presence. And so I also then had to anticipate the ways in which they would anticipate me being a criminal or me being a danger, or the ways in which I had to deal with my own fear and the fear of others.
One of the things you had mentioned when you talked about your time in New Orleans was, as a student, like, you actually would consider every morning what you wore and what signals it gave off. And I was wondering if you could say that better than I just did. What went through your head when you got dressed?
Well, before coming, I mean, getting dressed was just making sartorial choices. It was just an expression of who you are. You know, this is who I am. This is what I like. This is how I'd like to show myself to the world. So there's a slight bit of costuming that we all do. But that slight bit of costuming is saying, this is who I am. This is my identity. But I found that it changed, that I really put on layers, additional layers. The costuming was saying, I am safe. I will not rob you. I will not attack you. I'm not someone you have to worry about crossing the streets because you see them coming. I'm not someone that you have to call the police for. But I also had to put on a different kind of costume to not be the person walking around, for example, in jeans and white t-shirt, because time and again you'd hear the police reports, oh, somebody committed a crime. It was a black man. He was in a jeans, white shirt. He's 6'2". And I'm 6'2", and it turns out that somehow everybody committing crimes are my height. It feels like whether you're 5'5 or you're 6'6", that somehow people always saw 6'2". So I started wearing things that were so distinctive. Let's say a pink striped shirt with an unusual pattern, which you figured that you'd hard to see, that it would stick out so much that people wouldn't then say, oh, we saw him in a light-colored shirt, or we saw him in a dark shirt. It would be something that, if I were to be stopped and harassed, which happened far too often, then I'd be so distinctive in the costumes that I wore that people could say, oh, well, no, it's definitely not that shirt. That was so distinctive, I'd have remembered that. So I tried to wear things that would stand out, that would be memorable, so that if someone claimed that they saw some crime committed or someone doing something wrong,
I
would be mixed up.
Oh, sorry, Garnet. I wanted to read from a great essay that talks a lot about this called Walking While Black, and then ask follow up with a question. You say, in the city of exuberant streets, you're talking about New Orleans, walking became a complex and often oppressive negotiation. I would see a white woman walking towards me at night and cross the street to reassure her that she was safe. I would forget something at home, but not immediately turn around if someone was behind me because I discovered that a sudden backtrack could cause alarm. I had a cardinal rule: keep a wide perimeter from people who might consider me a danger. If not, danger might visit me. New Orleans suddenly felt more dangerous than Jamaica. The sidewalk was a minefield, and every hesitation and self-censored compensation reduced my dignity. Despite my best efforts, the streets never felt comfortably safe. Even a simple salutation was suspect. First of all, I really have enjoyed reading your writing. It's quite eloquent, and it really describes what happened. Do you have examples, some more examples of what happened there?
Well, I'm trying to figure which should I grab from the grab bag of examples, because the indignities were so constant and far too frequent. You know, one of the sad things is that you begin to learn to live with them and move in autopilot, that you've inculcated these habits. Oh, don't do this, do this, don't do that. Be careful how you say this, be careful how you do this. That eventually you start coasting on autopilot and accepting these indignities as the status, the status quo, and forget just how dehumanizing they could be, and they are. And but, for example, I would be walking behind someone, and someone white would come up behind him, and he would turn, he would register the person's presence, and he'd keep walking, same pace, not seeming apprehensive. And then I would come into view of the person. The person would turn around, would see me, and would cross the street and speed up. Or I've even had instances where someone would turn, see me, and just quickly run. Or, for instance, for example, you know, we're talking about walking, but there's a reason I talk about walking wild black and not running wild black, because that's something that I wouldn't do. I wouldn't run, because I had more than once where I was running for the streetcar. Lovely, you know, in a streetcar clanging its way down St. Charles Street. We've seen those images in New Orleans. Or running for the bus. And in short order, I'd be stopped by the police that someone reported a suspicious black man running. And you know, they were asking, well, why were you running? Well, I was trying to catch the bus. I was trying to catch a streetcar. I'm trying to rush to go somewhere. I'm running behind. And so I learned in short order not to run. That to run was to indicate that you had done something wrong and you were fleeing from whatever wrong you had done, whatever crime you had committed. And so I would rather be late and, you know, risk, you know, walking, or as we sometimes would joke in Jamaica, lead-footed, rather than, you know, make a quick rush and then raise alarm. So even the very pace at which I moved was something I had to monitor, which seemed for me just, it was quite a shock to move from a place in which I never had to think about my movement, except insofar as to say, is there danger approaching? Let me avoid this danger. And then suddenly to be thinking about my movement with such painful attention here that even the very speed with which I move, that, oh, no, I'm moving too fast. This could cause alarm. Someone might come and the police might be brought to my attention because suddenly I'm moving too fast. And so a fast mover or an erratic mover is someone thought to be a dangerous mover.
You wrote that you have, well, actually I will ask you, since I read this, have you yet experienced the luxury of walking's monotony? Is there anywhere where you can do that?
There's some places I can. There are many places I've had it. I think if it's so much not as places as much as moments and places. So I find it time and again in New York City. That New York City is also frustrating in the ways in which that's denied you in practice in some neighborhoods where NYPD sometimes will make it hard. But I've enjoyed that monotony of walking and getting lost in my thoughts and not being on super high alert in parts of New York City. I've actually experienced it in Charlottesville also, to walk in Charlottesville. And at most people think, oh, that's a strange guy walking around at midnight that loves night walking. But I've also experienced it in Charlottesville. And I've had different, well, run-ins is not the word, but encounters with Charlottesville police, you know, who've been gracious and generous with me, or they'll see me walking and say, well, how's the night going? I say, oh, fine. And they leave me to my own thoughts or leave me to my own wanderings. So there have been places and, you know, many moments in which I've had it and enjoyed it. But I've had it in New York City. I've had it in Charlottesville. I've had it, well, one could say, you know, on Sunday afternoons in the midst of the downtown, the tourist neighborhoods downtown in Chicago. But, you know, for the most part, I don't think of having it in places as much as moments in places.
You've walked 24 hours straight in New York City, and you wrote a book with Rebecca Solnit, I just learned, called Nonstop Metropolis.
Oh, yes, I was the editor at large, and she edited it along with Joshua Jelly Shapiro. So it's an unusual atlas, one could say. It's a new way of looking at the city through maps and essays interweaved.
So, what were your contributions in there?
So I was the editor at large, and along with being an editor at large, as a contributor, I wrote one short essay and two more full-length essays. One was an essay on what does it mean to coexist with people who you have deep differences with? What does it mean to also coexist with people with different ethnic and religious differences? So what does it mean to have Christians living alongside Muslims, alongside Jews, alongside Hindus, in an instant time in which we've come to fear, and more than fair, to demonize those who have a different way of seeing the world than we do, religiously or politically, or those who look ethnically different from us, you know, in terms of, you know, whether people look different in terms of their shade or their station in life. And so it feels like it's a time in which the stranger, the outsider, are treated like the other, are treated like them, and something to be feared and something to be avoided, something to be even kept out and away from us. But you go to Flushing, which is one of the most religiously diverse, perhaps the most religiously diverse neighborhood in the Western Hemisphere, at least, and you're seeing mosques, you know, just down the road from churches, and, you know, a Catholic church down the road from a Presbyterian church, down the road from a Baptist church, and a church in which, you know, you'll step and look at the signs outside and you recognize they have services in Spanish and Korean and English and Urdu. And so it's just marvelous to have seen that pluralism at work. And so I wrote about what was it like to walk through Flushing and to experience that pluralism on foot, to see, you know, up close the way people, you know, who have real differences in the way they see the world, real differences in the way they worship, real differences in the way they look and where they're from. And they're not killing each other. You know, they've learned how to coexist. And so it's just a defense of the outside and the stranger in a time when we're not defending that. And I've done it, you know, by way of walking. Then the other essay was an essay that spoke about what does it mean to think of immigrants on their own terms? What does it mean to move through the world as an immigrant and to see immigrants moving through the world on foot?
Let's talk about that after the break. This is WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville 94.7. And this is Apropos of Something. We're talking with Garnet Cadogan. He's a writer and journalist and walker. So we'll come back and we'll talk to him in just a moment. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and Apropos of Something with Nancy Lawrence and Ellen Daniels. We're here with Garnet Cadogan. He is a noted essayist. His research explores promise and perils of urban life, the vitality and inequality of cities, challenges of pluralism. We were just speaking about an essay that he wrote as part of a book he's co-editing right now, and you were talking about that, so I wanted to continue with that second essay.
Yes, and in the book it's called Round and Round, but it was also published online by Catapult. And if my memory is helping me, I think it's called How to Walk Around the World Without Living in New York City. It's either that or in a close variation of that.
And it's from Nonstop Metropolis,
that's
the book.
Yes, okay. It's one of the essays from Nonstop Metropolis, which came out last fall. But I just love walking, and so I like throwing myself into the city. The city just gives so much. I've always been a city person. I've always lived in city, you know, come alive in cities. And I find that even I leave and, you know, explore rural areas, which I really love, the suburbs, which my heart beats a little bit less quickly to, that I'm, you know, always still longing for the city, to the point where I even feel embarrassed as if I'm a city snob. But that's just how I'm animated. And I always hated hearing the way people spoke about immigrants from the cities. You know, it says immigrants were only spoken about in the terms of, you know, what service could they give to you? You know, or how could they entertain you? It's like, you know, so it's like, give us your dancers, your singers, your musicians, your restaurant workers, your dishwashers. And so I wanted to say, what was it like to walk around and see immigrants through their eyes, you know, try to see immigrants as maybe they see themselves? And to also say, what does America look like to an immigrant walking around? And so taking on the challenge of, you know, walking around New York City in all five boroughs, the joke is that you can see the entire world with a MetroCard, with that card that gets you on the subways in New York, that it takes you to so many different places, so many different neighborhoods, so many different countries. You could travel the world with a MetroCard. And I thought, well, why not travel the world on feet and on foot? And I began walking from borough to borough, from the Bronx to Manhattan to Brooklyn to Queens, you know, back to the Bronx, and then cheating by jumping on the subway and going across on the ferry to Staten Island and walking around and just experiencing the various different neighborhoods and showing how each neighborhood have all these very wonderful things to give away. And I also wanted to look at different ways of exclusion. So there's one way of excluding by saying, you know, you're not welcome. We don't want you here because of your religious beliefs, because of your, in a country of origin, because of your, you know, ethnic origins, you know, we don't want you here. You don't belong. You should be on the outside. But there's a different way of being on the outside that's not an awful exclusion. And it's, you know, hear all these different traditions and, you know, languages and ways of, you know, operating in the world that are a mystery to me, that I don't understand. And so I feel, you know, on the outside, you know, here in Nepalese in Jackson Heights, and I have no clue, you know, what their world is like. And so I'm on the outside, but it's not a pernicious exclusion. It's more like a mystery, and a mystery that beckons you and begs you to come and to learn and to listen and to keep engaging and to keep encountering and to keep interacting. And so that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to look at what I thought was a happy kind of exclusion, you know, for want of a better word, and one that, you know, invites you to come to get past it and to show different ways of being on the outside. And there is, you know, a way of being on the outside which was, you know, awful, you know, a way of caricaturing you and saying, this is what you're like, you're not like us, stay away. And then there's another way, which is, oh, here are all these mysteries asking to be, you know, unpacked and, you know, gotten past. And so I walked around and showed ways in which people could be here in the U.S. and at the same time be elsewhere. In other words, the ways in which they carried the old, you know, the old country or the old world with them, but also the ways in which, you know, they transformed it and also made something new. And so, you know, you also had a kind of America being formed that was, in a marvelous one, one to be celebrated rather than feared. And so suddenly the immigrants became more than just your dancers and your singers and your entertainers and your waitstaff and your service community. They became people who had, you know, rich lives of their own, asking to be discovered and to be learned about and to be engaged with. So I did it. Plus, it's also just fun just to keep walking around all these different neighborhoods and to have the bodies, it's, there's something about when you get exhausted. We all know it, you know, the term hungry, that the more hungry you get is the more real it gets. It's like, this is who I am. I have no time for your rubbish. My patience is out. And so there's something nice about walking and having the body, you know, get exhausted to the point where it has no choice but to be more honest about what it wants, more honest with people who you're encountering. And so it led to more honest encounters with the world, I could say. And so that was also something I wanted to push my body to a place of a little bit more honesty because of his actual exhaustion.
Is that what you mean by walking into your better thoughts, as you put it?
Yes,
that moment.
Yes, that's part of it. Yeah, and then also because there's something about moving through the world at such a slow pace that we're so obsessed now with two things. We're obsessed with mastery, that we need to master and control everything. Everything is about mastery. Even the way some people walk, oh, if I walk enough of these blocks, then I'll know everything and I know everybody and I can put a finger on, you know, this neighborhood is like this, and that person is like that, and, you know, that city is like that. And in our obsession with big data, if we have just enough information, then we can master everything. We can control everything. But walking becomes this lovely chastisement of that impulse to tell us that there's so much mystery in the world. There's so much that is unknown. There's so much that begs to be understood by repeated exposure. And even after that, it'll still be mysterious to us. And so the pace at which you move through the world, the ways in which the world, in a coming to you at such, in a slow pace, but also modern pace, in a coming to you in such direct contact, in the ways in which you're much more attuned to the texture of the world and people and the rhythms around you, does something to the body, does something to the mind, does something to the thoughts that allows you to come into a better self.
Do you ever listen to music when you walk?
Not much.
Yeah.
Because I think the streets have its own music. There's something about walking and hearing people, and it's the kind of snatches of conversation you hear. I have a friend, Jamie Attenberg, lovely novelist, who every now and then will post on her Facebook page the snatches of conversation she's overheard. And, you know, you'd be having the most despondent day, and then you read it, and then it just erupts in laughter. The kind of things that people say, the kind of things that seem to make no sense, but they make every bit of sense if what you're looking for is some kind of joy, some kind of humor, some kind of life in your day. And so to have music is to deny myself some of the kind of joys, the kind of surprises, the kind of pleasures, the kind of mysteries that lay in wait on those streets. So I just think the streets are, you know, these radiant arenas, you know, with so much that they're ready to throw at you, you know, so much in terms of joy, in terms of confusion, in terms of frustration, in terms of wonder, in terms of marvelousness. And so it's my attempt to not deny myself the many pleasures waiting on those radiant streets. And so I don't listen to music. Though, of course, some people have to listen to music. I think, for example, I mean, the streets, you know, also, you know, carry with them, as I speak about the ways in which I move and I am vulnerable because I am black. If you're a woman, there are also other vulnerabilities if you're a woman, continually being treated as prey. So in other words, I'm time and again treated like a criminal, and I have to do this choreography in the way I dress, in the way I walk, in the way I move, and even the way I give a salutation that communicates I am safe. It's as if I go in public space and I find ways to contract to say, you need not fear me. But a lot of women I know, when they go in public space, they have to expand. It's as if they have to say, don't mess with me. No, I'm not having it today. No, I don't need to smile for you. You know, because time and again, men say, oh, why are you not smiling? As if, you know, you're there to, you know, perform some dance, you know, or cater to their needs to see a smile. And so over and over again, they're the object, you know, of unwanted attention. And so they have to do their own strategy. So I have friends, you know, there are a lot of women I know who either listen to music or pretend that they're listening to music as a way to ward off attention, to say, if I don't have these headphones in, you know, people take it as a license or invitation to come and start having conversations with me and harassing me. So, you know, I'll have, you know, the headphones in. I'm actually not listening to music, but it's a way of saying, no, I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to be harassed.
Yeah, I've done that myself, and I get the I understand that you know you're walking for these into these radiant arenas that you so neatly called them, and the last thing you'd want to do is, or maybe, you know, is put music on in your, you know, to diffuse that sound with music. But I was just curious if there are ever times when you just want to see and you don't want to hear, you know, what's going on in front of you or around you.
No, it's maybe, some, I'm not sure what that says about my psychology. Maybe it's the ultimate extrovert, but I never ever want to. And there are times when I want to hear very little, and I'll take to the woods, for instance, you know, or I'll take to a hike. But again, I still want to be hearing the world, even if I want to be hearing very little, you know, very quiet. But, you know, for instance, I recognized when I was walking around New York City in the Bronx that more and more and more the birds started sounding like cell phones. So somehow these cell phones initially or tones were supposed to be imitating birds, but then I'm experiencing, well, I need to double check to make sure I'm not mistaken, but it feels like the birds are imitating the phones that were imitating the birds. And so there's something marvelous about that kind of discovery, which would be shut off from me, you know, were I to have my ears submerged in music.
So this is a little bit of a turn, but you were born with a different name, and we could find you under that name. What was your?
Yes.
What were you born with?
So my birth name was Ethan Levy, Ethan Brian Levy.
And how did that come about? How did the change come about? And what's the history of that name?
Well, my dad's surname was Levy, and his granddad was his dad was of Jewish origins, Dusty Levy. My mom is of Indian origins. My mom has an Indian last name, a very Punjabi last name, which I won't say just to protect her or not give her attention she may not want.
Sure.
But she has a Punjabi last name. My dad's last name is Levy. And my mom, at a certain point, wanted to not have any memories of my dad, who she's not especially fond of. That's a kind way of putting it, a very mild way of putting it. And so when I was 9, she had gotten married to Cadogan and decided to change my name. So she changed my name completely, first, middle, and last. But the funny thing is, having been born Ethan Brian Levy, got my name changed to Garnet Cadogan, the only thing my mom calls me is Chris, which is none of the first. It's nowhere in any birth certificate, not the first or the second. Because my grandmom didn't like my original name. She didn't care for my dad. And so she wanted to give me a good, solid Irish name. Well, of course.
Naturally.
Chris is not an Irish name, but nobody thought to tell it to my grandmom. And of course, they couldn't tell her that because her dad was Irish. So she'd be insistent that she knows more about, you know, Irish names than you do. And so she started calling me Chris. And by subversion one, I think when my mom was off to work, instead of calling me Ethan, my grandmother kept saying, Chris, Christopher, Chris, Chris, Chris. And the name stuck. And so out of exasperation, my mom calls me Chris.
It's really funny. So I could keep talking to you for forever, but unfortunately, we got to let the next people come in. So thank you so much for making, I know you had some effort to get here. Thank you so much, Garnet Cadogan. Author, journalist, all-around fabulous person. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Thank you both.
Yeah, it was a pleasure meeting you.
Thank you.
So, hey, Nancy, how you doing?
Well, I don't know. I'm doing fine. I don't know, Ellen, if we have time for a palate cleanser, do we?
Could you make it a brief one? A sorbet of sorts?
Kay.
I don't know.
Okay. There's a father with an Instagram account. It's called Two Slices of Toast. One word, one long word, but it's a numeral two. Two Slices of Toast. And he created this Instagram account for his daughter because she has severe food allergies and can essentially only eat toast every morning. That's the extent of it.
Mm-hmm.
So to make her mornings more exciting, he took it upon himself. He gives himself, for the time it takes for the kettle to boil, he's English, he allows himself two pieces of toast, and he creates these sculptures, okay, and he greets her every morning with them.
Wow.
And they're
thank
incredible.
You.
You have to check this out on Instagram. He's quite an artist.
That's amazing. I think
sweet.
I did see that. So we only have 30 seconds. Yeah, that's great. I wanted to talk about next week. Our guest will be Corbin Addison, award-winning author, world traveler, international best-selling author. He's a human rights activist. He's written 4 novels, and his true stories are just as good as the ones in his novels. So remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. We'll see you next week.